Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I am Brian Stelter. I am live in New York, and this is Still Reliable Sources. All right, here we go. One of the biggest media stories of the week is right here. It's the end of this show. CNN has canceled Reliable Sources. Yes, the longest running program on the network. NPR's David Folkenflik broke the news on Thursday. And I have a lot of thoughts about it, but I'm going to save those for later this hour. As most of you know, CNN has a new owner. Warner Brothers Discovery is making big changes across the company. And there's going to be more change all across the company, including here at CNN. And I'm sad that I won't be here to cover it. But since this is our final episode, we're going to do something a little bit differently today. This entire hour, it's a special hour, and it's about change. It's about change all across the media world. What's changing? What might change? And what must never change about the accountability function of journalism? You know, I love this show. This small but mighty show punched above its weight for so many years. Even a former president commented on the cancellation. Reliable Sources has been a one-of-a-kind show and a popular show. This is one of CNN's highest-rated weekend shows. So I want to say thank you to all of you watching around the world. I was lucky to be a part of it for 9 years, but it began 30 years ago, right after the Gulf War. So here's what the iconic former CNN CEO Tom Johnson said on Facebook when he heard the show was canceled. He said about the show's origins, it was founded by Ted Turner and leaders of CNN who felt very deeply that media organizations have a responsibility to report and to evaluate the journalism profession itself. That was the idea. It was a great idea. It is a great idea. And I know many of you are just like Johnson. You're going to miss this show. I want to say thank you to the thousands and thousands and thousands of emails and tweets that I've been receiving this week. I'm going to share them with the staff because they are the ones that have made this possible. You know, the thing about TV is that it's ephemeral, right? It's fleeting. It evaporates up into the air, and a lot of it is not even meant to be, a lot of it's not even meant to be remembered. But this program transcended that. It's a part of journalism school curriculum. Teachers across the country and in other countries outside the US, teachers use segments from this show all the time in classrooms, in lessons, guiding and teaching the next generation. You know, founding host Bernard Kalb and founding executive producer Rick Davis said this program was meant to be a critical lens on the media. Such a special phrase, a critical lens on the media. And this week, thanks to CNN management, we've been given the gift of signing off on our own terms and actually talking about the media industry. So let's not waste any more time. Let's bring in legendary journalist Carl Bernstein, CNN political analyst, co-author of many books, including All the President's Men, and most recently, the author of Chasing History. Carl, thanks for being with me on this final program.
Good to be with you, always.
I want to know, you know, we've talked so many times over the years about the role of the press, but it's changed a lot in the 30 years this program's been on the air, in the 50 years, for example, since Watergate. What do you think is most important about what's changed and what do we need to make sure does not change about American journalism?
I think the essential bottom line of reporting is to reach the people, the readers and the viewers with what Bob Woodward and myself for 50 years now have called the best obtainable version of the truth, which means even in some of the commentary or a lot of the commentary that it ought to be repertorially based, at least I hope I try to do that when I'm doing commentary. But more than that, you know, in this book, Chasing History, yeah. I think the most important line in the book, it's about what I learned as a 16, 17, 18-year-old going to work in journalism, is the line that I was taught by great reporters covering civil rights. And that is that the truth is not neutral. The truth is not neutral. That doesn't mean that we have to be fair in all we cover. We have to give acknowledgement to two sides. We have to be judicious, but not judicial. I know there's been a lot of angst about, for instance, calling Donald Trump, not on this network, but all over, a criminal. Well, you know, we called Nixon a criminal president in reporting on Watergate. In fact, he never was convicted of a crime, but he was a criminal president. Donald Trump is a serial liar, as I once called him on the air. And I said to myself, I hope that doesn't sound pejorative, because that's, and I reported, what most Republicans in the Senate of the United States regard him as. So I think we've got to do a better job explaining to our readers and our viewers what we do and how we do it. And at the same time, the bottom line has got to be the best obtainable version of the truth. And in fact, the truth is not neutral. Ask yourself this question. Is a lynching neutral? I've covered those kinds of stories. It's not neutral.
It's not neutral. You know, I didn't know if the former president's name was going to come up so early in the hour, but it's appropriate, because if I think about my tenure here at CNN, he's the story. He's been the story. He's been the defining story of the last decade, for better or for worse, or all of the above. So when we think about the media's response to Trump, maybe we got some things wrong. Have you thought about what we got right and what we got wrong in that past decade?
Yeah, I think we've gotten a number of things wrong, and I probably have myself. But I think the primary thing that we got wrong in cable news especially is when Donald Trump was running for president in the primaries, we gave him unprecedented free airtime. And I think that unprecedented free airtime, because we thought it was such good theater that we covered his plane swooping down to a campaign rally. We were there waiting kind of breathlessly. I think it was a kind of irresponsible coverage that we did. All the cable news networks did it. It gave him free ammunition to spread lies, to essentially give campaign speeches with us not making a decision about what is news. And that's the other thing that we do as reporters, editors. What is news is as important a function as we do.
Can we unpack that for a minute? I've been thinking so much about this lately. Some of the biggest stories in the world barely ever register as news. Certainly the climate crisis is getting more and more attention. But you think about homelessness. You think about the inability for future generations to own and invest and own homes. And all of these economic conditions, because they happen slowly, because we have drip, drip, drip things that are happening in this world, they don't get the attention that the sudden burst of from the fire hose does. How do we fix that, Cara? How do we make sure that the most important stories actually are treated like they're news? Like, how do we make sure it's news?
First of all, I think all of the areas you mentioned can come under the heading of the following, which I believe is the most important story in the world today that all news organizations, especially this one, need to be covering in great detail. And that is the pendulum swinging against democracy all over the world, in Western Europe, in the former communist East, in this country, where more and more we see authoritarianism, not just in the presidency of Donald Trump, but in the state legislatures, in the campaigns that we're watching now. But the decline of democracy, and it's metrically possible to measure it, the number of countries in the past 10 years that have gone from democracy to authoritarianism is increasingly rapid. And we need to cover it, even if it's not sexy. It goes to everything you mentioned.
Climate change, what if it's uncomfortable? What if it is uncomfortable? What if there is pressure not to do it, Carl? What if it is scary? I'm playing devil's advocate, so you can tell us, guide us as journalists what to do.
Well, I think this is a function of news organizations and of reporters and editors. You know, it's not very often in my 60-something years as a reporter, 60, I don't want to think how many years, that a good editor or a good news organization turns down a good story. I think as reporters and editors, we need to go to our management if somebody has said, no, you can't put that on the air. And we need to say, look, here's why this is a great story. You know, and I think both Jeff Zucker and David Zaslav have been committed through their careers to understanding what good journalism is. You know, when Zaslav came over to Warner, he was asked in that interview with Oprah, what's your favorite movie at Warner Brothers? And he said, All the President's Men. What is All the President's Men? It's a movie about all the things that we're talking about, how you go about getting the best obtainable version of the truth. I think Jeff Zucker was committed to that. It's basic. It's what we do. And again, it is not about neutrality. It's about fairness. It's about doing the reporting. It's about getting multiple sources. All of cable news has commentary. It ought to have commentary. It should be labeled perhaps a little better as commentary. But that's a function too, just as newspapers and old news organizations had editorial pages. We have room for both. We need to be doing both, but both need to be of the highest caliber.
I agree with you, and I love you, Carl Bernstein. Thank you for coming on. By the way, you gave me an idea just now. You mentioned All the President's Men. It's actually streaming on HBO Max. I think that's what I'm going to go watch later today. Carl, thank you for the inspiration.
Good to be with you always. Thanks, Brian.
I've got some time, you know. I need some movies to watch. All right, up next, freedom of the press is under fire. It's exactly what Carl just mentioned. So we have two more really important guests to talk about it. Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, and Jody Ginsburg, the president of the Committee to Protect Journalists. They are both up next.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Reliable Sources, where for over 30 years, we have been talking about the role of the press in society around the world. The press has continued to come under assault in many countries, and increasingly right here in the United States. We have seen threats. We have seen murders of journalists in some countries. We have seen illegal detentions. We have seen so many attempts to stifle freedom of speech, including just recently here in New York State with the stabbing attack against author Salman Rushdie. I'm showing you some clips, some examples of our coverage over the years, and that's just a small snapshot of the examples. So here to talk more about the risks to journalists and what can be done to defend the free press, Jody Ginsburg, she is the president of the Committee to Protect Journalists, and Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. Thank you both for being here. Jody, tell us what viewers at home need to remember, need to know about the climate for the free press around the world.
Well, people need to understand are two things, I think. One is how vital journalism is to democracy. You know, we don't talk about freedom of the press because journalists are special creatures who need special defense. It's because journalism plays a vital role in upholding democracy and holding the powerful to account and exposing corruption and keeping us safe and providing information. Think about COVID that provides us all safe. At the same time, this vital pillar of democracy is under threat like never before. Already this year...
When you say like never before, compare that for me. What has changed in 10 or 20 years? Why?
Well, what's changed in 10 or 20 years is a few things. Firstly, increased political polarization, right? We're seeing a decline in democracy worldwide. Carl Bernstein alluded to this earlier. countries that should be democracies upholding basic human rights, fundamental freedoms, are not doing so. And in that decline, they're also increasing their verbal attacks on the press, their discrediting of the press, because in discrediting the press, that enables them to avoid scrutiny. And we've seen that in the likes of Donald Trump, who called the press enemies of the people. We've seen that in Bolsonaro in Brazil.
So around the world. But the counter-argument, at least here in the United States with regards to Trump, is the media has failed the country. The media has failed the public. Trump is channeling the appropriate anger of the public. What do you say to that?
I think what you need to recognize is that journalists do an incredible job worldwide covering issues that matter to the people, whether they do that in their local context. And frankly, that's where they're under most threat, actually. Local journalists reporting on local issues are under
very
most threat.
Very important to remind of that, yes.
They're not all working for CNN. They're not all working for Fox. These are journalists in their local communities reporting on local issues. Think about the Boston Globe exposing the issue in the Catholic Church, for example. Think about local journalists covering the tornadoes last year in Kentucky. Those are not journalists who are out of touch, as is presented by the likes of Trump, with the people. Those are the people. They're inside their communities reporting on issues that are important to their local communities. And often, those are the people who are most targeted. When we look at the journalists being attacked worldwide, being imprisoned, being killed, most often they are local journalists.
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to understand. What we've seen is backsliding in democratic countries. So I want to bring you in on that, Jeffrey. This backsliding in democracies, leaders trying to turn the public against the press. What are you thinking about in your newsroom at The Atlantic? How are you all trying to counter these threats?
Well, the important thing is not to be fooled, right? Authoritarians obviously see the press correctly as an adversary. The press is trying to get the truth about their authoritarian tendencies and their behaviors. Authoritarians, in order to stay in power, need to convince the people that the press is the enemy. And what we need to do, I think, well, we need to do a couple of things. The first is to stay the course, right, and report the truth plainly and fearlessly. And the second thing we need to do is a better job as an industry. And I'm not a person who believes that the media is one thing, obviously, but we need to do a better job as individuals, as organizations, of explaining why we do what we do, why it's important for people that we do the things that we do. And going back all the way, going back to what the founders of this country said, obviously the leading avatars of democracy 250 years ago, talked about the indispensability of a free press. And we need to educate people about the indispensability of what we do to make democracy work. When you have an authoritarian in power in this country or anywhere else, obviously they're going to be working directly against that interest.
Thomas Jefferson once said that the press is impotent when it abandons itself to falsehood. But in some corners of the American media, that's happened. They've abandoned, they've accepted falsehood instead. Jeffrey, is the rest of the media doing enough to counter, to call that out, to call it what it is?
I can't speak for the rest of the media.
I think The Atlantic has. We've tried to here, but I wonder if we're not actually meeting this moment and speaking about the threat to democracy.
Look, we've been slow. We are obviously, like anybody else, we have our traditions and our norms of the way of doing things. But what's happened in politics in the last 6 or 7 years is abnormal. It's not normal in the usual way that things have gone in the United States. I think we have been, many organizations, many individuals have been slow. And I understand it. It's completely normal. I think we were slow. I remember 6 years ago, not wanting to use the word racist to describe Donald Trump and, looking for all these kind of descriptions, racially charged rhetoric and all this kind of stuff. And finally, you realize, you know what? You've got to speak plainly and you've got to speak directly and call things what they are. So we do use racist, and we did not use lie to describe lies for a long time. But now we do. So I think we're catching up. But we also have to at the same time explain why we're doing that in a bit. We're defenseless in a kind of way because we've made ourselves defenseless because we assume that everybody understands who we are, what we're doing, why we're doing it, and how we do it. And I don't think that's enough anymore because there are people who are casting aspersions on the role and methodology of a free press.
Right. Look, they're calling the media evil when, in fact, the media is just flawed. We're just flawed. Jody, how do you react to what Jeffrey said?
I think that's right. I think we haven't always done a great job of explaining why journalism is important and kind of showing our workings, right? How do we do things? How do we know something? I think what's increasingly challenging at the moment is when facts become up for grabs, that's when it becomes difficult. You know, the job of a journalist, we always say, is not to ask people whether or not it's raining and take both sides. It's to go outside and feel the rain falling on you. But we're in a moment where even if you go outside, feel the full raining, the rain falling on you and tell someone, they might still say fake news, right? So part of our job has really got to be to re-engage people, re-enthuse people about facts, the importance of facts, the importance of agreeing on some key fundamentals and some key information. And I think the other thing that's really important that we've got to keep doing is making sure that journalists are properly supported, that we have the financial support that journalists need, but also that they have the backing of those in authority. You know, when those in power denigrate journalists, journalists become fair game. And then what happens is what you see is that morphs into online harassment. We've seen a huge escalation in online harassment over the past 30 years. And that, unfortunately, quite often then morphs again into real world violence against journalists.
Here's a fear that I have, Jeffrey, and I'd love to hear how you react to it. That online harassment Joey is describing, that environment of toxicity around journalism that is, frankly, much more poisonous than it was the first time you were on this program, Jeffrey. It's gotten so much more toxic, right? And doesn't that scare off some writers? Doesn't that turn off some reporters? Don't we lose a generation of great journalists because they don't want to be a part of that? They don't want to be harassed on the internet. They don't want to be a part of the mess. How do we ensure that we're still getting the next best class of journalists to join in this profession and help tell the truth around the world when we are under this poisonous cloud?
Right. That's interesting because I don't know if I worry as much about recruiting young journalists, young people into journalism. You have to have guts and you have to want to take risks in your life, and you have to not want to make that much money. You have to do a whole bunch of things in order to qualify to be in journalism. And we're seeing good people come into journalism. Of course, it's a worry, but some people who don't want to come in won't come in. I'm worried about ownership level as much as I am what happens in the newsrooms themselves. I mean, I think we need to make sure that owners understand that they have a responsibility. You own a media outlet in America. You have responsibilities. You almost have, I don't want to call it constitutional responsibilities, but you have a civic responsibility that's very different from owning a chicken restaurant or a car company or whatever. I mean, you have to be willing to stand up to authority. You have to be willing to lose friends. You have to be willing you have to be willing to accept that there's going to be government pressure against you. And that's what, I mean, and that's a larger anxiety because they control the paychecks.
I was so proud to be here for the years that CNN, you know, and I'm talking only the past here. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. So proud to be here, Jody, at a time when CNN was standing up so strongly, not because they were standing up to Trump's threats, but because they were standing up to a government that was threatening the press. Regardless of political party, the press has to stand up to that pressure that Jeffrey's describing. So anyway, let me get out of it. I want to give you the final word.
Of course we have to stand up to that kind of pressure. I think we have to recognize that's becoming increasingly difficult. If you think about the pressure for people like Nobel laureate Maria Ressa, who is subject to graphic, constant online harassment, that is something that is a real challenge, particularly for female journalists to deal with in the modern age, and is frankly unacceptable. And we have to be doing more to support those individuals so we don't find a whole generation is put off from journalism or indeed self-censors, which is even potentially worse.
Worse. Jody and Jeffrey, thank you both for the conversation on this. Up next, information overload. Do you feel it? What can we do about it? I'm going to ask a panel of all-star media reporters and critics. That's in just a moment. You know, today we're talking about 30 years of reliable sources, 30 years of change across the media industry, and what might come in the future. So joining me now, three of my favorite guests over the years, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, Claire Atkinson, the chief media correspondent at Insider, and David Zerwick, CNN media analyst professor of media studies at Goucher College. Welcome, everybody. Eric, you once guest hosted this show, actually more than once, so you get to go first. Let's talk about the last 30 years of media. What's been the biggest change in the media world in the 30 years this program's been on the air?
Well, I want to talk about, from my point of view, as a person of color, I wrote a book called Race Baiter that talked about how media outlets use prejudice and stereotypes to make money. And I think one of the things that we've seen is that that's become much more obvious. There's been much fewer code words used. We see people like Tucker Carlson talking about the great replacement theory. We see this disingenuous debate about critical race theory. And indeed, you know, the last segment of the show, the very first show that I guest hosted, you know, when we were transitioning from Howie to you, I talked about how media outlets use prejudice and stereotypes to fuel their ratings, to fuel their success, and how viewers needed to resist that. And I'm sad to say that all the trends that I identified in my book have only gotten worse. You used to have to decode what they were doing. Now they say it outright. Mm. And I think what it's about, much more important for people to resist that kind of thing.
What about diversity in the media in 30 years? I would hope you'd agree. There actually have been some strides in representation, but not enough.
There have been strides, not enough. And certainly, I think we're trying to resist the groupthink that happens in media, where even when you have people of color, they're approaching covering the news from a white male perspective. And I think that's something that the industry has resisted. And that's why we're seeing, you know, these fights at organizations like the Washington Post and the New York Times.
Yeah.
We even at NPR sometimes struggle with that. We have younger reporters that are pushing us to be better on diversity and to reflect a wider range of perspectives. And yet we have this orthodoxy inside some news organizations that make that more difficult. And I think that war is going to continue.
Let's get to Claire Atkinson for 30 years of change. What would you say the biggest change you've seen or covered in 30 years of media?
Yeah, well, I guess big tech has had an incredible effect on how we all do our jobs.
30 years ago, no cell phones, no internet.
Yeah. Everybody's a journalist these days. You have a phone, you can record things, you can share them. One of the negative consequences is that everybody who has a social media account is suddenly a media critic. You know, we talk about trust in the media. So many people have criticisms, conspiracies. It's fascinating to see what gets shared on social media. As we know, Alex Jones has been able to profit off of that. No consequences for lies. It is a crime to lie in a court. It is not a crime to lie in a political ad. In fact, there's no rules. Facebook is able to share those ads, and there's no accountability. On the flip side, we've been able to share all our
work. Please tell me something positive, Claire.
Share all our work and be able to, you know, create ourselves as individual brands that people want to follow, and people will clearly want to know what you have to say about the media well beyond CNN's tenure.
David?
It's not the biggest, but I think it's really important, and it fits in with what Carl was saying. It's a subset of democracy under assault, and it's the accelerated demise of local journalism. And that may even be a euphemism for what's happened to local
journalism. And I, Marylanders at heart, we've seen it firsthand.
I had to bear witness to it. You know, 30 years, in 1989, when I came to Baltimore Sun, two papers, the Sun had foreign bureaus in London, Africa, South America. It was... To say it's hollowed out is another euphemism. It's another euphemism.
Another euphemism.
And here's what worries me.
Yeah.
Yes, papers were owned in its glory years by rich families. But they did have a civic sense of responsibility. They did see themselves as partially public service. They were invested in the community. Now you have hedge funds like Alden taking over those papers. And there's one thing, make money. And there is, to me, that's why I left the Sun. I mean, we talked about this in that podcast. I left it. But think of some of the cities 30 years ago, the kinds of papers they had in Buffalo, in Cleveland, anywhere. St. Petersburg was a great paper. That's gone. And I'll tell you, it's so true. This has become a cliche. But when you take away that local coverage, and I mean by good journalists who could be working elsewhere, not people minimum wage where they can't afford to live because they take people young, and as soon as they join a guild and make enough money, you get rid of them and they get other people who are cheaper in there. When you take that away, the so-called public servants, the politicians, will just run wild at
That's
the state
right.
capitals,
That's right.
at City Hall. And I've seen it. I've seen it in Maryland. I've seen it in Baltimore. And it kills me because I live in Baltimore.
Right. And know? That's why we need these outlets, the nationals and the locals, to remain strong and healthy. And what we can do, Al, as consumers, is subscribe.
Yes.
We can all put our money where our mouths are. Sign up for your local outlets. Support your local news outlets. Just a few dollars makes a big difference. Let's talk about the next 30 years. This program, I think we should run some of the great interviews. There's been some interesting, weird, crazy interviews in this program. Glenn Beck once walked off the show on live TV. We'll show some of these clips as we talk here. But as we think about the next 30 years, Claire, let's talk about CNN first. What do you see as the future of CNN? What is its role? What is its place in this crazy world?
Well, I think your new owners, and John Malone specifically, would like to, or they want to bring it back to the center. Quite what that means, I guess, is a conundrum when the news cycle is about a former president who removed documents from the White House, the January 6th committee.
Crimes and crimes and crimes. And let's give us context. John Malone, who is he? Tell viewers who he is.
He is a libertarian, multi-billionaire, owns a lot of ranch land in America, is the father of cable in many ways. He came up with broadband and made it a business.
He's a cable icon. He's a hero
Absolutely.
Of the cable business.
Yes.
But the reason this is important, here's what he said to the New York Times. He said in an email to the New York Times, Malone said he had nothing to do with the cancellation of reliable sources. Malone said he wants the news portion of CNN to be more centrist, but I am not in control or directly involved. Have you been reporting this out? I know that's strange for me to
ask,
but I will.
Well, I think that's a good question that people are asking. Is John Malone responsible for axing your show? I don't know the answer to that. I think people might suspect it's political. He is a libertarian who believes in not paying taxes if he can avoid it. But the question is, you know, he said he's not directly involved.
Right, to be clear,
that's an interesting
quote. He denied.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then I think he's a businessman. He's looking at where the money is, where the audience is. And the viewership on the left is split between CNN and MSNBC. And the viewership on the right is all at Fox News. They have a bigger audience, lots of money.
True.
And perhaps he's saying, you know what, if we shift a little bit this way, maybe we'll get that too. But he acknowledged in the meantime, there's going to be the possibility of people leaving CNN and the possibility that ratings go down.
Right. And then there definitely will be more change. I only know one thing. I know I'm going to be rooting for this place for the rest of my life. David, centrist. Is there anything wrong with that word? You know, it's a pretty innocent word.
Centrist. Brian, nothing
Let's
wrong.
Let's be centrist.
Nothing wrong with it. But here's what happens. Huh. People reduce this conversation and they say, "Don't just facts. Facts, just give me facts. Facts is not enough. Yes,
wait,
facts
why?
First. Facts, context, explanatory okay. journalism, which this show does. You have to explain the situation.
Okay.
You have to explain why is the CDC doing, has it been doing such a lousy job on information on COVID in the early stages of it? That's an explanatory journalism story. You can give the facts, but sometimes the facts don't tell you anything if you don't give a context, a histori-. You know, on all of Trump, when he was president, President Trump stuff, you regularly had Carl Bernstein on and others putting it in a historical context, comparing what he did to what President Nixon did or what LBJ did or someone else. You need to do that. And they give Pulitzer Prizes for explanatory journalism, by the way. It's reputable. But people say, oh, just facts. Go in online and say, oh, give us facts. No, this is a larger thing.
Okay.
We also set the parameters of what's of the civic conversation of American life. Huh. That's what you also do on this show. My hope for CNN, just as I said, local news is pretty much gone, and you have these big papers, the Times, the Post, Wall Street Journal, a few others. It's the same thing in TV news.
Mm-hmm.
Local TV news is not very good, as you know, in a lot of cities. I don't think it's very good in Baltimore.
Except for my wife's show.
No, no. New York is different.
You're absolutely right.
New York
local
is now
TV news has been hollowed out.
Right.
It's part of that challenge.
And so my hope for CNN, more than ever, this is the most important cable channel, I think, right now, to set a standard for journalism, Brian.
All right.
And I pray to God they do it.
I'll tell you what,
doing it.
My old mentor, David Carr, he has a saying. He would say, oh, it's getting spicy. It's getting spicy now. Let's keep it going. Eric, last word in this block to you. What would you add to this conversation about CNN, the future of the media?
Well, I think the problem is that people put a political lens on top of something that is about preserving democracy and about holding politicians accountable. When you have one politician who's denouncing the press as the enemy of the people, when you have one politician who insists that he won an election that he did not win, when you have one politician who is blaming immigrants unfairly for America's ills, you have to have a journalism apparatus that is free to call out those excesses without fear of being accused of being unfair. And I think that's the problem. I hope that what we're not going to see CNN do is institute some sort of false equivalence where the extremism of one party is balanced with the regular dysfunction of another party. We need to be free to call out when someone breaks the law, when someone breaks norms, when someone introduces prejudice and stereotypes into the public debate. We need to feel free to call those things out without being accused of being unfair politically, when what we're really doing is trying to see things very clearly and root out the most negative anti-democratic impulses that have risen to the fore in a lot of our public debate. And, you know, I'm concerned also that it will be hard to hold on to viewers if all you do is just give them facts. They do need context. They do need free and fearless exploration, even when you have to look hard at a political party or look hard at a political candidate and say this person is breaking the law or breaking norms. Will CNN have the courage to do that? I hope so.
You know, I've always been a producer at heart, so let me say, take camera three. Let's go back to camera three. This is the panel. Eric Deggans, David Zerowick, Claire Atkinson. Thank you all for the conversation.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
For what you've done on this show.
Up next here, we're going to end this program the way it began 30 years ago. You're going to like this. The very first guest from the very first episode of Reliable Sources will join me live with a message about the future of the free press.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
All right, you ready for a little Reliable Sources trivia? Who was the first guest on the program, the very first program? His name was Brian Karam. He appeared on Reliable Sources on March 7th, 1992, when Bernie Kalb was anchoring. There was a segment about, quote, the fine line between rudeness and toughness in questioning the president. That's because Karam, you see him right there, he shouted at President George H.W. Bush during a press briefing. Now, at the time, Karam was a reporter for KMOL-TV in San Antonio, and he was fired for the incident. That's why he was on Reliable Sources then, and now he's with us for the final episode. Brian Karam is the author of the book Free the Press and the host of the podcast Just Ask the Question. So, Brian, my question for you is, gosh, you haven't aged a day. Look at you. How did you do that?
Thanks.
No, that's not my question. My question is, you've heard the guests this hour. What do you want to add to the conversation about what journalists need to be doing today and in the years to come?
Well, I think, Brian, all of your guests have hit on a couple of really good points. And I want to go back to something that Jeff said. I mean, I'm a former president of the Maryland-Delaware District of Columbia Press Association, so I know well what the problems are. And you, being from Maryland, know them as well. The problems in local journalism are brought about by government, right? That's the bottom line. Over the last 40 years, beginning with Ronald Reagan, the rails have been taken off. Consolidation in the news media business means today, though there are twice the number of people on the planet as on the day that I was born, there's about half the number of reporters. You need to hire more reporters. Diversity is an issue because we don't have diversity of ownership. When you have diversity of ownership, diversity of thought comes into play. And then, of course, we've always, you asked earlier about, you know, attracting the right people. Journalism has always attracted the right people. It's hard keeping them. When I first walked into the Brady briefing room in 1985, it was Helen Thomas who introduced me to the world. And it was, of course, my mentor, Sam Donaldson, who said, Brian, take a look at that first row in the Brady briefing room. There's seven people in that first row. There's 200 years of experience. Of course, he said Helen had 190 of it, and they exchanged, you know, a couple of quips between each other after that. But he was right. And today you have reporters that are hired and brought in to major beats, not just the White House, but Congress and others that have had no experience. We need experienced beat reporters to do the job. Vetting facts is our coin of the realm. When I ran newspapers, I would have reporters come to me and say, hey, this is what I think. And I go, I don't care what you think. I barely care what I think. What do you know? Vetting the facts and framing them and putting a narrative out there that frames the facts in a useful way so that people can use the information is the chief problem that we have today. And it's what we will face going forward. And it's, I think the future actually is bright. I think the future does portend well for reporters and for, I mean, we can never be first anymore. Social media is going to beat you to the you know, event. If there's a fire, whatever, shooting, there's Fair going point. To be someone with a phone there before we are. What we are coin of the realm and what these shows do, like yours and others, is make sure that we have vetted facts. We're first with vetted facts. That's the most important thing. That's what makes us relevant and will always keep us relevant, no matter what the platform, if we remember that going forward.
I'm glad we ended here on a positive note. Brian Karam, thank you for being the first and the last guest on this program.
And thank you for having me. It was always a pleasure, Brian.
Thank you. I want everybody to know CNN's media coverage is not going anywhere. It's going to continue. The newsletter will be back in the coming weeks. Oliver Darcy will be leading a team of reporters, and you should sign up at ReliableSources.com. And if you want to know what I'm thinking right now, let's just wait. Let's take a break, and then maybe I'll have a few more thoughts. Hey, look at the time. You know, this is a really, really unusual day. TV networks rarely have a show like this, a show all about the media. And networks, even more rarely, cancel a show but still let it have one more live episode. I don't know if I've ever seen this happen before, okay? So here we are, together, in a super strange situation. So let's talk about it, okay? The phenomenal Reliable Sources producing team has been working around the clock on this special hour ever since Thursday. No one from CNN management has reviewed my script ahead of time. They have no idea what I want to say. And as the control room very well knows, I typically go off script anyway, so I want to thank a few people and then tell you what's on my mind. First, I want to thank my wife. This is a selfie that she snapped on the very first day. The very first day I had the honor of hosting this show. It was right before we were about to get married. Before all the kids, before all the craziness. But every Sunday I was here with you, my home team was working too. So thank you, Jamie. And to my kids, my amazing kids, you know, sometimes it feels like the only time they ever really want to play with me at home is when I'm running out the door to work. They're going to be in for a surprise this week, right? Thank you to Jeff Zucker for believing in me, for having the back of this organization for so many years, for having my back through everything, even through the death threats. Thank you to Amy and Tellus for calling me that day and asking me to try out for Reliable Sources. Thank you to Andrew Morse for letting me expand the Sunday show into a newsletter and a podcast and more. And, this might sound weird, but thank you to CNN's current boss, Chris Licht, for letting us say goodbye. Thank you to everyone at CNN Business for digital leadership. Thank you to my hero of an executive producer, Jonathan Auerbach, and the producing team that makes this possible. Jamie, Diane, Eden, April, I will do whatever I can to help you all in the future. Thank you to the technical staff, the control room geniuses, the editors, the floor directors, the PR people, the camera operators, the guest greeters, the makeup artists. You are CNN's sources of strength. And we need strength. As some of you know, I've been a media junkie for a long time. I was the kid who spent his days building the school website and producing the school TV show. And deep down inside, I think I'm still that kid. I never thought I'd actually be on TV. I might have dreamed about it. I never thought it would happen. I just liked writing about TV. I know this is gonna sound like BS, but I actually thought I didn't have enough hair to be on TV. I am just that kid who loves television and loves the internet and thinks that these are incredibly powerful forces in our society and believes that we need to interrogate that power and face it head on and figure out how to make these tools work for us and not against us. That's what it's all about, right? That's what Reliable Sources have been about. It's documented and dissected the changing media world for 30 years. I mean, we're living through an era of dizzying change. We have supercomputers in our pocket. We are all members of the media now. That's probably the biggest change that's happened while this show was on the air. And by the way, that's why it's loony to say the media is the enemy of the people. The media is the people. People are flawed and opinionated and curious and hopeful and believing in accountability. And that's the watchword here. Accountability. So this show's going away, but there's going to be so many more. We need to have room for media criticism and debate and discussion, and we will. So much of the media ecosystem in 2022 is garbage, but so much of it is spectacular. The hard part's sorting out the treasure from the trash. These are thorny, complicated things. I know I didn't never had all the answers. I didn't even always have all the questions. But it was the gift of a lifetime to get to confront these issues on international television with the backing of CNN. Here's what I do know. I know it's not partisan to stand up for decency and democracy and dialogue. It's not partisan to stand up to demagogues. It's required. It's patriotic. We must make sure we don't give platforms to those who are lying to our faces. But we also must make sure we are representing the full spectrum of debate and representing what's going on in this country and in this world. That's why CNN needs to be strong. That's why I believe CNN will always be strong. You viewers at home, it's on you. CNN must remain strong. I know the 4,500 staffers are going to do their part to make it stronger than ever. But it's going to be on you to hold CNN accountable. And not just CNN. You got to hold your local paper accountable. You got to hold your local digital outlet accountable. It's on all of us. We are all members of the media, all helping to make it better. That's what I believe. I can't wait to be watching CNN, seeing what happens in the future. I'm going to be rooting for it. I want CNN to be strong. I believe America needs CNN to be strong. I believe the free world needs CNN to be strong. And it will continue to be, because all of us are going to help make that happen. The free world needs a reliable source. So, for reliable sources, for the last time, I'm Brian Stelter. Thanks for being with us.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.